From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Open lines later tonight with a special Truckers Hotline. Now, a reminder that Art Bell returns to the airwaves on Coast to Coast this Sunday night. His guest will be none other than physicist Michio Kaku. Now, during that program, there are some things that Art wishes to say, and as you can imagine, this period for him has been an extremely difficult, grieving time. I, like you, am glad that he has decided that it's best to get back on the air. For the rest of your life, you will hear a number of talk show hosts with different styles and techniques. But take this from me. You will never, never hear one better than Art Bell. He is in a class all by himself and always will be. Sunday, when the clock strikes the appropriate time, and you hear that voice from the high desert, you will know that Art Bell is back. Well, some tragedy in West Virginia. Rescuers searching a smoky cave for two coal miners. Here we go again. After a conveyor belt caught the fire deep underground in the second major mining accident in West Virginia now in less than 3 weeks. Close to a day after the fire broke out, safety crews had yet to make contact with the two men. It was unclear exactly where in the mine the men were. They were equipped with oxygen canisters that typically produce only an hour's worth of air. The fire broke out Thursday night at the Alma No. 1 mine. Rescuers were hampered by really heavy smoke that cut visibility to 2 to 3 feet. After the blaze was brought somewhat under control Friday, rescuers spread out to search four tunnels, each about 4 miles long. The mine extends as much as 900 feet below ground. The governor of West Virginia has said this: their odds of survival are a little bit long. Sad story there. The government sought Friday to pinpoint exactly when Osama bin Laden recorded his most recent warning about planned attacks on the United States, a key fact that could help determine the risk that terrorists will carry out that threat. Intelligence officials said analysts were scrutinizing the audio tape by the al-Qaeda leader for any clues, including certain words and phrases that might be a signal for the terror network's members or followers. They spoke on the condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to speak publicly about this matter. The Homeland Security Department said it has no plans to raise the nation's terror threat alert level and no reason to believe an attack was imminent. The audio recording was the first public statement by bin Laden since December 2004. That is the longest stretch that the terror leader has been publicly quiet since the attacks of 9/11, 2001. Authorities would not say whether the recording indicates anything about bin Laden's whereabouts or his health. And that Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad met with leaders of the Palestinian groups Hamas and Islamic Jihad in Syria, expressing his support a day after 20 people were wounded in Tel Aviv in a suicide attack claimed by Jihad. The Israeli defense minister says Syria planned the attack and that Iran funded it. Iranian and Syrian officials have denied any involvement by their countries. So this situation in there, the Middle East, is getting very, very tense. The Dow Jones Industrial Average plunged 214 points Friday in response to rising energy prices, poor earnings from General Electric and Citigroup, and concern over what's going on in the Middle East. The price of oil shot up to almost $69 a barrel. Here we go again. And the Dow fell 2.7%. The Turkish gunman who shot Pope John Paul II in 1981 has now returned back to prison 8 days after being freed. Turkey's highest appeals court has ruled that Mehmet Ali Atka, 48, should serve no more jail time for killing a Turkish journalist in 1979. There was a public outcry when he was released early last week, and the government challenged that decision, but he had previously served 19 years in prison in Italy for the attempt on the Pope's life when they let him go, but he's back in now. We'll see how long. Japan has halted all imports of U.S. beef because of mad cow fears. threatening millions of dollars in American trade and sending officials scrambling to repair delicate business relations, Japan's sudden order came just 6 weeks after the country had lifted a 2-year ban on American beef. What happened? What was the problem? Well, this time, the discovery of bone, a mad cow disease risk. Asian countries say it came in a shipment of veal from a plant in New York. In a moment, our guest and investigative reporter, Linda Moulton Howe, as she will talk about a very strange situation that occurred many years ago with UFOs, discs that interfered with our own V-2 launches in 1947. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, her name is Linda Moulton Howe. She's an Emmy Award-winning writer, television producer, investigative reporter, and author who goes directly to the men and women at the forefront of science and environmental challenges. First-hand eyewitnesses of very high strangeness. She's a graduate of Stanford University with a master's degree in communication. She has devoted her documentary, film, television, and radio career to productions concerning science, medicine, and the environment, and goes fishing for all kinds of strange stories. She's back for 2 hours tonight with Linda Moulton Howe. Hi, Linda. How are you?
Well, thanks, George, and Happy New Year.
You too. You too.
Kind of a chaotic world we're in, but
indeed.
I pray for more peace in this roadkill planet every day. And the reason why this research about 1947 V-2 rocket problems is relevant today in 2006 is that it's becoming very clear that the United States government was shooting at the aerial discs that the media and the public were calling flying saucers and UFOs back then. And that is something that no one knew. And it has only been in the last few years that trickles of leaks and the work of a New Mexico State rep, Andrew Kistner, that I'm going to talk about here in a minute, that he dug up because he was being, I guess, guided is a good word, by people who were inside sources at White Sands and a friend of the Naval Research Lab. And they said, you've got to look at May to July 1947. You've got to dig in the newspapers. You've got to make FOIA requests. This is where the emergency in this country began. This is why there's been a policy of denial. It is, George, as if we have to go back to the 40s in order to understand this very strange, persistent policy of denial in the interest of national security that still seems to have a chokehold in all parts of this story from this administration and all previous administrations about why they won't let the truth out. And this started for me back in the mid-1990s when I was approached by Andrew Kistner, and a little background on him. He had been working at the time as a consultant to a major defense contractor in Las Cruces, and he had earned a bachelor's of science in political science from Arizona State University in 1974, and he was hired out of college to work in the Montana Trade Commission as an energy projects manager. And that work put him in touch with Atomic Energy Commission scientists, other engineers, and military personnel. And later, he was elected to public office in New Mexico as a state representative between 1996 to 2000 for Doña Ana County, and his base was Las Cruces. And that is the home of the White Sands Missile Range. And when I first met Andy at a conference in Roswell, he had a lot of documents that he had received after talking with confidential inside sources at the nearby White Sands Missile Range. And he said that he also had a sobering conversation with a friend who worked for the Naval Research Laboratory. And that man had told Andy the United States government during the Truman administration had fired on unidentified aerial discs, and that at least one had crashed and been retrieved near Roswell. The NRL source said that he had seen with his own eyes the anti-artillery holes in the disc, and he had seen that in a facility in Albuquerque.
What a story, Linda.
Well, this is, and this is why this is so relevant today, because as this unfolds tonight, you will begin to see what I feel the big picture is beginning to emerge of a government that was running so scared in the Truman administration for reasons that we can talk about a bit later.
Sure.
But that they were shooting, but what they were shooting at retaliated. Andy, he had all this guidance, and he began assembling a book manuscript of what he was learning, which included this suggestion that I said, that he go specifically to southern New Mexico newspapers, as many as he could find, for May through July of 1947. And this is a quote from one of his sources, because the national emergency started there, unquote. Andy was convinced that there had been military aggression by the United States against the disc technology, as he called it, and retaliation. And that retaliation, Andy concluded after his research, affected hundreds of civilian and military airplanes, which crashed in a short time period in the summer of 1947 and in months afterward. Andy was so provoked by his sources and independent research that when he was elected to represent Doña Ana County, he explored more New Mexico history and learned another startling secret, that there was had been, and the facilities were still there, and nobody knew about it. A top-secret radar facility had been ordered by President Harry Truman himself only 4 months after the notorious July 1947 UFO crash made newspaper headlines. And that radar was built in El Vado, north of Los Alamos, to protect the Atomic Energy Commission's Manhattan Project while it made the atomic bomb. Two other radars were built in Moriarty and Continental Divide, and that formed a huge triangle with El Vado. And all of that was to protect not only Los Alamos, but Sandia Base and Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque, where scientists and engineers also worked on the Atomic Energy Commission's Manhattan Project. And eventually, Andy gave me his book manuscript, which he had entitled Peculiar Phenomenon, a phrase that the White Sands base commander had used to describe the strange unidentified radar targets that showed up instantaneously at V-2 rocket launches and appeared to cause rocket tests to veer off course and crash. And I'm going to talk in more detail about that in just a bit. But first, George, I would like to share with you and our Coast audience why Andrew Kistner had such a serious interest in the UFO phenomenon from his teenage years. Here now is Andrew Kistner.
In 1969, I had a daylight sighting above the Delaware Dam in Delaware, Ohio. And it was myself and a friend of mine about 10 o'clock in the morning. And the performance of this craft, and it was a flying disc, was extraordinary. It was something that I'd never seen anything like it before, and my friend hadn't seen anything like it before either. And we watched it in the sky, kind of skipping around in the sky for 10 or 15 minutes, a long time. And then it flew directly straight up and disappeared. And it was moving so quickly between points in the sky from a hover in the transition to another hover that it actually became invisible between the two points. And then when it went straight up, we looked at each other and we said, my God, that was a frightening experience just being that close to one. And about 30 seconds later, the flying disc came down over this lake, over this reservoir, about 100 feet away from us, and did like a slow rolling motion about 10 or 15 feet above the water. And there was absolutely no question that it was a technology that that neither one of us had seen before. It was always kind of in the back of my mind that there was absolutely no question that flying discs are real, and that somebody had to be investigating that technology. So throughout my career, I came in contact with a number of interesting folks related to investigations of flying discs.
And that's how you came to talk with that Naval Research Lab contact?
Exactly. He had been a naval officer and had been working with the Naval Research Laboratory in a research and development capacity related to naval vessels. And we were on the topic of what he knew about flying discs and UFOs and that kind of thing. And he indicated to me that he had been briefed in the subject while he was in association with the Naval Research Lab, and he had been actually physically shown a flying disc that was described to him as being Roswell from in the Sandia Mountains or in the Monzana Mountains in the nuclear weapons complex there. But he wanted to clarify in my mind that in fact, he had actually visually seen one up close in U.S. custody.
Did he tell you where and what date?
He told me it would have been in 1965 or 1966, sometime in the mid-60s. And as close as he would get would be Sandia National Laboratory and the weapons repository.
And we're talking about Albuquerque, New Mexico, Sandia Base, and Kirtland.
Correct. It was controlled by Sandia, but it was physically in a weapons bunker.
Describe all the details you can remember that he said about the condition of that disc.
The condition was that it had exit holes through the top of the disc that were made by anti-aircraft artillery fire.
He thought that the disc came from what year?
He said it was Roswell. That's what Roswell was.
Which you would have interpreted as 1947 July.
Correct.
The implication is that we, the United States government, shot it down?
Absolutely. I think it was understood between us that they were not necessarily friendlies. They weren't necessarily hostile. But it was a unique piece of technology that needed to be looked at.
And isn't it true that at that period of time, something that a lot of the American public does not know, is that one of our major generals referred to the disc technology as, quote, an enemy weapon system, unquote?
Correct.
And the general who defined the disc technology first as a enemy weapon system was who?
It was General Twining.
Nathan Twining.
Exactly.
And why do you think?
He was actually involved with the Air Materiel Command, and the AMC was responsible for doing a lot of the weapons-related research through the Ordnance Bureau for the United States Army. He was also related to the V-2 test program, and the V-2 test program is where flying discs, I believe, became a real nuisance.
It's riveting, Linda.
Well, and now, George, let's go a bit further into some of Andrew Kistner's research about this May 1947 time period in which there were V-2 rocket experiments going on at White Sands. Then it was called Proving Ground. And these crashes that were linked by the commander of the White Sands Proving Ground directly to the peculiar phenomenon of discs showing up. And you and our Coast listeners can see some of these actual headlines, photographs, documents that have been found in only the last few years about this peculiar phenomenon interfering with V2s at my news website, www.earthfiles.com. And when you go there, it's the headlines page. And at the top, I have, for the first time, I have, with Andrew Kistner's permission, I am reprinting electronically, since it hasn't been published in paper yet, all of Peculiar Phenomenon, the manuscript, and it is now up through the 9th segment, and I have opened up segments 8 and 9 tonight that are relevant to what we're talking about, so that everybody listening can go and see for yourself what Andrew Kistner found about this history. And when you go to the heart of this matter, why was he being directed by these inside sources at White Sands? Go to May to July 1947. Dig around in the newspapers. Well,
we'll be back with you, Linda. Hold on. And we'll be back with Linda Moulton Howe in just a moment as she continues with this riveting story of what happened in 1947 at the White Sands Missile Range. By the way, the last couple days to go, and that is it for the January issue of the After Dark newsletter, where you get the predictions issue. We're down to like 150 copies. That's it. So take advantage of it, and you'll still be able to get the free CD, Art Bell's interview with the late Father Malachi Martin on exorcisms. So call 1-888-727-5505. You can go online, coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Linda Moulton Howe. Linda, the state representative, the former state representative, Andrew Kisner,
right.
Did he use this at all as a platform when he got elected?
No.
Or he did not?
No. He knows how difficult any of this is. And when he did that research that finally found, it's Andrew Kisner who is responsible with his friend Scott Ramsey in finding those three radar stations that they had been there. They even found the remnants, and it had been so classified, George, that no one in the state of New Mexico even knew that they were there, had played a major protection role. And you know that if you have triangular microwave shooting up in the sky, anything, any airplane that would go through them could be damaged badly. And a question that was left from that research and finding that there was a triangulation of those strong radar installations that no one knew about is, could they also have interfered with these disks? We don't know, but it is Andrew Kisner trying to put this puzzle together quietly, doing true and straightforward historic research in the state of New Mexico as a representative, but being guided in the work that he was doing by people who actually had inside knowledge. And this story, he told me, Andrew Kisner said, Linda, I never thought that I would find what I found. And the more newspapers I went through, it started unfolding in front of my very eyes. And he said, and the implication begins to fall around you like heavy bricks. My God, this government back in the 40s was trying to bring down out of the sky at an advanced technology, and that advanced technology retaliated. And just before the break, I was going to say, let's spend a couple of minutes going into a couple of dramatic events that happened, and then we'll hear Andrew Kisner comment again
okay.
on some of the information that he learned. But I'm going to just go right to his own words in this manuscript called Peculiar Phenomenon, and this is how he begins, quote, the most highly classified episode in American military history began with a series of events on May 15, 1947, that ultimately resulted in the crash and recovery of at least two, probably three, and possibly four extraterrestrial flying discs. This was accomplished by deliberate anti-aircraft artillery fire. The U.S. Army's actions either caused or were a response to offensive overt acts initiated by flying discs themselves. Whatever flying discs are, they are not defenseless. Their special weapons were and even now are unconventional. Flying discs were immediately defined by the United States military in 1947, George, as a, quote, enemy weapons system. And you know who made that classification? General Nathan Twining. This is information that has just emerged in the last few years as well. Okay, now, so what happened? There is so much that is unfolding in Peculiar Phenomena at Earth Files from the actual manuscript, and I'm just going to hit some highlights.
All right.
On May 15th, a V-2 gets launched, and it but was supposed to go to an altitude of 84 miles. It was carrying instruments to measure cosmic and solar radiation temperatures, ionospheric measurements, and photo experiments for who? The Naval Research Lab. But the V-2 rocket veered off 40 degrees suddenly and crashed east of Alamogordo. If it had been just a mile or so further, it could have ended up killing people, and it would have been a big public story. But it's always been something that people didn't hear about because it was largely local newspaper coverage. And here is a headline from May 16, 1947, Las Cruces Sun News article. V-2 goes astray, lands in 6 miles of Alamogordo. Lieutenant Colonel Harold R. Turner, White Sands Proving Ground commanding officer, blamed peculiar phenomena for the erratic test flight of a German V-2 rocket, which landed. It was 6 miles east of Alamogordo, but I think it was only about a mile from some area that could have affected people. Well, now, Andrew Kissner, knowing he had inside information, he says that what never was put in the papers, never was said publicly, but they knew what was going on at White Sands, that that peculiar phenomena was a radar target that instantaneously appeared next to that rising V-2 missile, and immediately the V-2 rocket changed course at exactly that moment. In fact, this was such a problem, George, that they put cameras, they mounted cameras right inside of the V-2 rocket, cut out a hole where the lens would be, and they photographed those disks pacing at exactly the speed of those V-2 rockets. Now, it really became dramatic 2 weeks later. We're talking only 14 days after. And dear Colonel Turner, I feel sorry for this man, base commander. He's trying to get all of this V-2 rocket research going, and he's got something he doesn't know what. They're assuming that it probably is from outer space. There are disks, and they're showing up next to these missiles, and it's causing the missile to veer off. And he decides that he's going to do a secret May 29th, 1947 launch. No one is to know what's going on. Andrew Kissner thinks this was the American military's first test of a surface-to-air missile strike against an unidentified radar object. And the result was terrible. The rocket took off. It went. It was going. And suddenly, the rocket seemed to make a 180-degree. You know, it's going one way, and then it's coming right back the other way.
They turned it.
But then there were two explosions. One was over in Mount Franklin, which is on the New Mexico side. And the other was down in Juarez, Mexico. And that explosion, this second huge explosion, left a gigantic crater in the ground not very far, again, from a new airport that had been built there. And here's the kicker. We go down, the military, the Mexican military get there. They're very upset that American military have crossed their border without any consultation. That's how important, apparently, we thought it was. And they went to find our V-2 rocket, and there was nothing, literally nothing.
It was blown to shreds.
But the issue was, if it was vaporized, what vaporized it?
Right.
And the dot, dot, dot is, this was both our attack and retaliation in one event. And what happened after the Juarez, we'll call it maybe, first major secret war, was a whole series of air crashes. And we're talking within 24 hours of May 29th, two major crashes on the East Coast. And we're talking about up to 80 or 90 airplane crashes that Andrew Kissner was able to confirm occurred between May 29th, Juarez, and June 12th, and that is only 2 weeks. And we're talking about planes going down all over the place. And now, let's hear Andrew Kissner.
All right, here we go.
We attempted to shoot and find us down on May 29th, at least one. I think there probably were two or three in the immediate area around that launch site. And the result of that was a series of aircraft accidents the United States has not seen before or after that lasts for about a month.
And in your research and in the manuscript of Peculiar Phenomenon, you put together a graph showing how many airplane crashes there were after the Juarez rocket came down or missile came down. And there was a 12-month period, wasn't it, where there were about 600 planes that had crashed around the world?
Right. But that doesn't include what we're saying now is that doesn't include all the other ones that probably have not been reported in the course of doing my investigation. What I found was that each newspaper, and I would scan 8 or 9 different newspapers for the book, each one had different aircraft accidents that weren't mentioned in the other newspapers. By June 12, 1947, the U.S. Army Air Corps has grounded all their C-54 aircraft, and the president has called for a special investigation of airplane accidents that I think at that time, I think the number was 70 or 80 since May 29th. The president called for a special investigation into the aeronautics system in the United States.
And Andy, you mean between May 29th and June 12th of 1947, there were 80 or 90 airplane crashes in the United States.
Exactly. And John Steelman, who was the assistant to President Truman, was quoted by one of the reporters there as saying there was something radically wrong in aviation.
Len Stringfield, before he died, told me that he had firsthand knowledge that we had a standing order in the United States Air Force to shoot down the discs in the sky between the end of the 40s until at least 1954, somewhere around 53 to 54, but that we lost so many pilots trying to carry out that order that it was finally rescinded.
Okay, I can believe it. I could believe it. And that goes back to the real schizophrenia of this whole subject. You know, how can you try to shoot down something that doesn't exist, or how can you successfully shoot down something that doesn't exist? And then the other popular one is that somehow flying discs are invincible and they can't be affected by earthly weapon systems. And I think that's been propagated to an extent by our own military, saying that you don't want to mess with these things, and you're not going to be successful even if you try.
Right. It was described to me once as Earth's secret war.
Yeah.
We're talking a decade later after you completed the manuscript. Have you heard anything more from any of your inside sources at White Sands or the Naval Research Lab?
As a matter of fact, I think that this entire subject matter is more highly classified today than it was in 1994. And that kind of flies in the face of the traditional thought that sometime in the future things are going to be declassified. But I think that the security classification, if it could be twisted up, has been twisted up a notch since 1994. In terms of the folks that cooperated with me on the book, they are professionally engaged in different activities, and I have not visited with those folks for the last 10 years.
Because it's dangerous to them, right?
It's dangerous to them.
And why do you think that it is all even more classified today than it was 10 years ago?
I think we have a different vision of security since 9/11. And I think that the security system continues to consider this to be a very troubling phenomenon, but also a very highly kept state secret.
Has anyone ever, off the record, said to you who they think some of the non-human entities are and what they want here on Earth?
No, as far as theorizing, I felt that led me off initially was in the direction of this book, was a very thoughtful former Army officer who was a friend of mine. And I asked him, well, I knew that the technology existed because I'd seen it, but flying and doing his performance. But I asked him, I said, do those craft have occupants? And he said, as a matter of fact, they do, but they're not the kind of people that you would invite over for Sunday brunch. And I didn't ask him to go into detail, but it was kind of an ominous statement to make. Mm-hmm. That he just basically said they're not the kind of people you'd want to associate with.
And George, by June 15th, 1947, President Harry S. Truman ordered a special board of inquiry to investigate American air safety. You can see these headlines in the New York Times and newspapers all across the country. And among his appointees was Dr. Jerome C. Hunsaker, chairman of the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, and it is Dr. Hunsaker who is also listed in the top secret Majestic 12 list as advising President Truman on the extraterrestrial presence. And 5 years later, on July 29th, 1952, newspapers again across the United States, most people have never heard this before, but I have the newspaper and I'm reading.
I've never heard any of this before. Well, Linda, this is first time for me too.
This is why it's so important to get it out, because I think this is beginning to give some insight about why there has been such a stern policy of denial for a whole bunch of reasons. And the culpability of shooting at something that you had no control over, couldn't control, and had no idea what it's going to do, you might say was stupid or desperate.
Yeah.
5 years later, in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, there was a newspaper headline, Air Force orders jet pilots to shoot down flying saucers if they refuse to land. Now, doesn't this seem like a disconnect? How could we still, after all of this, and Len Stringfield saying we lost all these pilots and there was supposed to be a rescinding of the order, in 52, that was the big year over the White House when they had the double squadron of whatever over the White House, and there was a tremendous flap in 52. Well, between 57 and 52, whatever we had learned, whatever we had lost trying to shoot disks down and their retaliation, we still had a standing order, and we have finally found a newspaper that has this. And it said, the Air Force revealed today that jet pilots have been placed on a 24-hour nationwide alert against, the word is against, flying saucers, with orders to shoot them down if they refuse to land, unquote. Now, all of this forms a fabric here in which you can begin to look at everything else that has unfolded that we know about since the 40s. And I know we're running up against the break.
You've got a minute and a half, Linda.
Okay. When Lieutenant Colonel Corso, before he died, told me that one of the greatest concerns that our government had was they didn't understand the agendas, and that one of the things that, how do you even know the policy to have if you don't know what the agenda is? And if we were shooting down, were we the first to shoot, or was it a reaction? And that is not clear. But if we had this standing policy for at least 5 years, and if Len Stringfield's firsthand knowledge is correct, that we lost so many pilots, none of this has ever been said to the public. Honestly, it has all been covered up in, I'm just going to use the word lies, because that's honest. And you know how our government officially explained the 180-degree veering Juarez rocket, two explosions, no rocket found. They simply said it was a gyroscopic failure.
And what about all those planes that went down in that very short period?
All explained a whole bunch of ways, and yet, there on that night when the Juarez rocket, there was an editor of the local newspaper who saw it with his own eyes and reported in the newspaper that he could see what looked like, and this was in the newspaper, first magnitude stars near where the rocket went off course. And it was still twilight. It was not even dark. There would not have been two first magnitude stars where they were. And this again raises this issue of the peculiar phenomena all over the place around the V-2 rocket launches. And this whole other subtext, George, We were shooting at them, and they were retaliating in unexpected ways.
What a riveting story. Linda, I got to tell you, one of the best I've heard you do, and you've done some incredible work. We're going to be back in a moment. Phone calls now with Linda Moulton Howe. We can talk about this story. How about those structures found near Cuba that some people think might be Atlantis? How about an update from Linda on that? What about these geysers that keep, well, heating up? She's done some stories on that. All that and more on Coast to Coast AM.